oldest son, who is living temporarily with him, comes into the kitchen to heat up tonight's dinner, buffalo wings. Mr. Marcel shuffles into the kitchen. Scott wants his dad to get his knees replaced as soon as he can.
No matter what, he still has a chance to be the $6 million man.
For the California Report, I'm Sarah Varney.
Finally today, a short personal note. For the past 8 years, I've been privileged to host the California Report morning show, but today, my last day doing that. KQED is giving me more time to get out into California to do more reporting, and that's what I'll be doing. Starting Monday morning, you'll hear Dan Dreyer behind the microphone, and I know you'll be in good hands with him. I won't be going too far, though. I'll still be hosting our weekly California Report magazine that many stations air on Friday afternoons or Saturday, and you'll still hear my reports on this morning program, too. Oh, and if I sound a little different, it might be because I've had a bit more sleep. That's the California Report for Thursday, November 16th, a production of KQED Public Radio. I'm Scott Schaefer. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the California Endowment for coverage of healthcare in California and the James Irvine Foundation. Sponsoring the James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards, with information online at www.irvine.org.
Well, that was the California Report. The California Report was brought to you tonight by Fabric Indulgence and Art Supply at www.fabricandart.com. It's 7:02, and it's time for Education Now. Education Now is being brought to you tonight by Mendocino Market and our members. And Mendocino Market offering Branningham turkeys and all of the fixings for your Thanksgiving needs. Catering and deli platters are always available. Made-to-order sandwiches, homemade desserts, and salad. 937-3474 for orders are open daily, 10 to 6:30 and 10 to 5:30 Sundays on Ukiah Street in Mendocino. And we thank them and our listeners very much for supporting KZYX and Z. This is KZYX 90.7 FM Philo, KZYZ 91.5 FM Willits and Ukiah, 88.1 FM Fort Bragg, Mendocino County Public Broadcasting, listener-supported community radio, and it's time for Education Now. Here we go with some music.
You, who are on the road, must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they fix, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry, so just look at them and cry.
Well, I'm Athena Melville, and it's time for Education Now. And tonight I'm sharing an experience of a live presentation in St. Helena, California, on Thursday, November 9th, 2006, with Madeline Levine. Madeline was greeted by an audience of over 300 people in the elementary school auditorium. The event was sponsored by a consortium of community service organizations, hospitals, schools, and social services. Tom Amato coordinated the event, and I give him special thanks. And special thanks also to Junior Artegas for strapping my recorder to his video camera so that I could share at least a part of the two-hour event with all of you. The voice of Madeline Levine is a welcome voice to everyone who works with and loves children. Over the phone and in person, you are greeted by an authentic person. So here she is, speaking on the price of privilege. Her latest book, which is now in its ninth printing. So enjoy. And here we go, I hope.
Because I wrote a book about these very high rates of emotional problems among affluent kids. And I want from the very beginning to be clear that I'm not talking about rich kids. I'm talking about upper middle class kids. We don't know a thing about rich kids. Nobody has ever studied them. And nobody had ever looked at upper middle class kids until about 9 years ago. And as an aside, you'll hear lots of asides. The reason that we came to know something about upper middle class kids was one of those accidents that often happen in science, which is the field of psychology is actually quite young, started during World War II, and the object of much research was the middle class. And then in the 60s and the 70s, it became inner city kids who were really study kids in poverty. A gal named Sunia Luther, Yale PhD, head of the Department of Psychology at Columbia, was an expert on inner city kids. And in the way that researchers sometimes like to make their findings even more powerful, she thought, what a great idea. I'll compare these inner city kids to upper middle class kids. It's going to make them look really awful. And what happened, in fact, was that the upper middle class kids looked substantially worse than the inner city kids. And so, you know, you have that once and you go, okay, maybe it's an accident. And you have that twice and maybe it's an accident. At this point, she has studied kids from Greenwich, Connecticut to Mercer Island, Washington, and is finding the same phenomena over and over. And that's that upper middle class kids have three times the rate of depression, three times the rate of anxiety disorders, substantially higher rates of substance abuse, of cutting, self-mutilation, and of psychosomatic disorders compared to the general population of adolescents. So I want to be clear that I'm not talking about sort of spoiled rich kids. It's a very easy topic to trivialize, and I've certainly learned that by having spent 4 months speaking to the media. I'm not talking about spoiled kids. I'm talking about truly impaired kids, kids who are being tested on instruments that are the same instruments I use in my office for assessing whether or not a child is clinically depressed. Now, three times the rate of depression, and we need to remember that depression carries a mortality rate with it. Lifetime mortality rate for depression is 10 to 15%. So we're talking about, you know, I hate to be the person who comes in with the scare campaign because I think that leaves people nowhere except scared. So I promise you that by the end of this, I'll have some ideas about how to bring down those rates. But the fact is that high school, upper middle class girls have a 22% rate of depression. You would expect to find somewhere between 7 to 9% in spite of what you said about adolescence and learning about adolescence, and it's really hard to believe. Adolescents actually do not have a higher rate of psychological illness than any other group, which doesn't seem that way at all when you're raising them. But it's true. So we have a 22% rate of depression among high school girls. We have about a 25% rate of anxiety disorders among, that's one in four kids. That is just astounding, and it meets full criteria for an epidemic, according to the CDC, according to the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta. Now, if you've got 22 to 25% of kids who are depressed or anxious, and overall what they're finding is 30 to 40% of kids meet criteria for some psychological disorder. That tells me that there are even more kids who are just plain unhappy. That tells me that there are even more kids who are being affected by what I'm going to talk about in a few minutes, what I see as the culture of affluence, than just the kids who are hooked on coke or slitting their wrists or crying in their rooms or any of that kind of thing. So, I mean, I think there is a kind of pervasive unhappiness among the upper middle class in general. And by the way, I think Harper Collins has already asked me to write the next book, and that's going to be about the parents. And about, for those of you who've read my book, probably mostly about the moms, because that's what I know about and that's what I see. And, you know, I've sort of kidded around. I said I'd give my PhD back if we find that the moms and the dads' rates of unhappiness are particularly different than their kids. I mean, the first sort of foundation of psychology is a happy child begins with a happy family, and of course that makes sense. So I think there's a kind of pervasiveness of unhappiness. I think it has a lot to do with the culture. I'll talk about why over the course of the next 45 minutes or so. But I think you do need to know that all these sort of anecdotal stories that you read about, you know, the press is really fond of sound bites instead of sound analysis. And so we never get the context. You know, you hear about a group of kids who left somebody for dead at a party or overdosed, you know, at a fraternity party, but there's no context ever for it. And I feel it's really important to have that context, that it's not just some crazy place on the North Shore of Chicago. There was a story recently about a kid who was perpetually late for class. And the reason he was late was he got there so late that he couldn't park his BMW. And so he was constantly late. And the parents' solution to this was to buy a house across the street. And that way he always had a parking spot. And it only came to national attention when he, entrepreneurial, I assume like his father or maybe his mother was, he started selling parking spots on their lawn. And the police were called and it made the papers. So, you know, it's really easy, I think, to look at stories like that and go, you know, North Shore, Chicago, or Scarsdale, or Greenwich, Connecticut, or Marin County, you know, and sort of blow it off. But it's not just in places like that. It's not just anecdotal. It really is across the country, and it's affecting every single community. And by the way, I don't think it's restricted to upper middle class kids. I think a lot of what I'm going to be talking about is hitting kids in general, but the news is that it is hitting upper middle class kids, because I think we've always assumed that like poverty has such tremendous, you know, economic and social challenges that we assume that kids from lower socioeconomic status families would do poorly. And I think there was a corollary in there. And I think the corollary was that money and parents' education was somehow going to have a protective effect on children's mental health. And it's really sort of confusing, I think, to keep getting this data that says that's wrong. You know, there's something that looks like a toxic effect. And we'll see it's not actually money at all that's toxic, but there's something in upper middle class families that seems to be having a toxic effect instead of the expected, you know, leg up on kids. So why? Why should kids who have involved parents, I mean, my practice is all Kentfield, Ross, and Marin County. You know, it was very, very important to me not to write about Marin County because we have enough jokes about us, some deserved and some not so deserved. But I had been thinking about writing this book for about 2 years and had been speaking to people around the country. And we were all sort of seeing what we felt was a fairly new phenomenon over the last some people say 5 years, some people say 7 years, of a particular kind of kid who is, I'm going to describe in a minute, sort of bland and vacant and still highly functioning. But I didn't want to write it until the data was in, because it's really different to say, like I said, you know, this place or that place has sort of messy, screwed up kids, and to say this is going on across the country. So once the data started coming in, and it first was published in 2002, so it's really new, that's when I went ahead and decided to write it. Okay, so, you know, those are the facts. Them's the facts. Those are the facts. Why? Why should these kids be in trouble? And I think there are three reasons. The first is probably the simplest, and that's that there are unconscionable levels of pressure put on upper middle class kids. And whenever I say that, I see there are a couple of teens in the audience, which is really, really nice. Or maybe you just look really young. You're 16. Terrific that you came. Thank you. And usually if there's a kid in the audience, when I say they're too pressured, they go, duh. I don't want to in any way come across like I'm saying we shouldn't be pressuring kids, or we shouldn't set a high bar, or we shouldn't have expectations for our kids. We absolutely should. Part of the job of being a parent is to set the bar high for your child, is to have expectations. That's not what's disturbing to kids, but the level of expectation has become, and I will, delusional. I think it has become downright delusional. When I have a kid who won't go home, who comes to my office and says, I cannot go home, my father will kill me, I was just cut from the varsity team, or I have a girl come into my office with a handful of pills saying, I'm thinking about taking these because I got a C instead of an A and my mother's going to toss me out of the house. When that's what's happening to kids, when kids are feeling that alone and that loved only on condition of their performance, then we have more than high expectations. We have kids who believe, if there's one part of what I believe, it's right here. Kids who believe that they're only as good as their last performance. And if you think about that in your own life, at the very point when life gets tough for you, when you've had a bad day at the office, when you haven't done so well at whatever you do, that's the moment when you want and need the people who say they love you the most to be at your side. I mean, I can't imagine coming home and saying to my husband, the talk up in Napa was, it wasn't that great. And he goes, well, I'm really disappointed in you, Madeline. You know, you keep that up, you're not going to be speaking anywhere. I mean, and that's what life is like for so many kids. Life is about what they do and not who they are. And so my book opens with a story of this girl who sort of became an icon of the kind of kid I treat. And she walks in, and she's very well put together, and you know, good social skills. Hello, Dr. Levine. It's a pleasure to meet you. But she's wearing a cutter uniform, which, if you're in the field, you know exactly what that means. It means a T-shirt, you know, that's sort of like really low, and there's a hole in the thumb, and it hides. You know what I mean? The teenagers now, and it hides all the cutting on the arm and on the wrist. And so about halfway through the session, I asked her if she'd show me what was under her T-shirt. And I can't remember. She was wearing either Prada or Marc Jacobs. She was wearing a $200 T-shirt. And she lifts it up, and she had taken a razor that morning, so it was still sort of weepy, and she had carved the word empty into her arm. And that girl became, she's the start of the decision to write about this, because she really captured what it was that I was seeing. And that was kids who really looked actually okay on the outside. She didn't come in, you know, in the old days, if a depressed kid came into a psychologist's office, it took about that long to figure out that they were depressed. You know, their hair was lousy, they didn't have their makeup on, they were what we call psychomotor retarded, which meant that they walked slowly and they laid down. And you know, the pediatricians, my oldest son is 26, good Lord. And we used to get a card, signs of depression. You know, and the first one was like poor hygiene and failing grades and withdrawal from friends. The kids that I'm seeing don't look like that. Most of them look fine at first glance. Their grades can still be great because when you're doing a lot of coke, you can party and then stay up all night and study. And often they're popular, or the captain of the soccer team or the lacrosse team. But just like this girl, you pull back the Prada, and this kid is bleeding. And I think what's happening to these kids is she becomes an example not just of how hidden things are, but of how the solution for so many kids has become to present a really good front in spite of a tremendous amount of psychological distress. And I think that distress is of a very particular sort. And that has to do with this sort of valuing of external markers of success. So the kids come home with an A and their parents are delighted. They come home with a B or a C, and in my community, frankly, it's a B. A B, you might as well get an F in Marin County, or certainly at the private schools, because that's where a B puts you. And I have a private school that's very angry at me, so I won't mention it by name, but I just had a kid come in. I'm going to get killed. It's my own community. Talking about communities, you know, you do have to work within them, right? And a counselor at this kid's school said, she's a lovely kid. And you know, the fact is, this is really tough in communities like this, the fact is most of us are average. And when I used to talk at Brandeis Hillel up in San Rafael, I had built into my contract every year that I'd be allowed to give a talk on the average child. Now, nobody ever came to that talk. So, in retrospect, I'm not sure that it was totally out of commitment or the fact that I had to give four talks and I knew one of them wouldn't be attended, so it made it, you know, easier on me. But no, nobody has an average child. And the fact is that for all of us here, there may be things that we're really good at, and there are just as many things that we are incredibly average at. And to expect kids to excel academically and to excel on the athletic field, and talk about delusions. I mean, do I have coaches in here? Any coaches? Now, coaches are usually actually on my side, but I think what's going on with athletics has become actually incredibly, incredibly dangerous to kids. The kind of competition, the notion that your kid has to be pushed and pushed and pushed. It's not good enough to make the JV team, you've got to make the varsity team. It's not good enough to make the regular team, you have to make the select team in my community. And how's that for telling kids what our values are? The select team, that's what it is in Marin County. Which means what? That the other kids are not select. Which sounds to me like you're talking about beef, right? You go to the butcher and you want, you know, the select. I mean, it's just a hideous, horrible way of talking about kids. And I think it makes it really clear what the values of the community are. So we'll get to sports. But it's sort of like there are these couple of baskets, one of which is academics, definitely important in child development, one of which is athletics, and given obesity and eating disorders, definitely important in child development. And then there's this huge other basket of child development. And in that basket are things like, simple things, like how do you talk to the opposite sex? How are you respectful? How do you learn self-control? How do you learn what you're interested out in the world in? What do you want to be? How do you delay gratification? All the things that go into becoming a person out in the world. And that basket, in my opinion, nobody's really paying much attention to. As long as kids are shining, as long as kids are doing well, the assumption is that other stuff will fall into line. But on the contrary, it doesn't, as a matter of fact. It falls out of line because it's been neglected. And so in Tiburon, which is my neighboring town, there was a young girl, 16. She was the local cocaine dealer. Everybody knew she was the local cocaine dealer. The school went to her parents. Her friends went to her parents. Mental health workers went to her parents. And her parents repeatedly said, there can't be anything wrong with her. She's a straight A student, which she was, which was my comment about what you can do when you're on cocaine, you know, for some period of time. And it wasn't until she led the Tiburon, the highway patrol, on a high-speed chase down 101, slams herself into a brick wall, and ends up in three months of intensive care, were her parents willing to say, yeah, there was something really wrong? And I think that experience of looking at kids and seeing only what they present externally, which is, you know, sort of what we're accustomed to doing. Oh, she looks okay. You know, her grades are good. She's popular. She has friends. It just isn't doing it anymore because we have kids who have learned how to look good. They've learned exactly what you want from them. They've learned exactly how to present themselves. And yet, in spite of that, we've got 30 to 40% of kids meeting full criteria for psychological disorders. And I think what they've learned is sort of to work the system. They've learned how to cheat. They've learned how to ruin their neighbor's paper. They've learned how to get mom to do their homework for them. I don't know about here. In my community, when it's diorama night, do you have diorama nights here? Yes? Yes? Diorama night dioramas are these things that kids, for those who don't know, you know, kids in the fourth grade in Marin, you have to do a mission project. So everybody has to do a mission, right? And you walk in, because they always have it ready for back to school night, everybody's laughing. You know what I'm going to say. And it's like, there are the talents of all the architects and interior designers in the community, right, on display. And your poor child's diorama made out of, you know, toothpicks and lollipop sticks, absolutely pathetic. And he's going, "Mom, I told you!" And, you know, it's the most visual moment for me of seeing how involved parents are in their children's lives. I mean, what the heck is the point of doing your child's diorama? What's the point of, I had two kids in my practice, the electricity goes out. The grid goes down in Kent Woodlands. They're both in the middle of their final history paper. They're kids, they both lose their work. And one kid, and they're both really upset about it. One kid sort of bangs around his room, sits down, stays up the entire night, and rewrites his paper. The second kid says to his mother, "Ma, I have a big basketball game. It was right before break. I have a big basketball game. I've done all my notes. Would you please write it for me?" This is not an unusual story. And she does. And she's not being a bad mom. She's not. She believes that she is going to make life better or easier for her child by taking over that task for him. But in fact, what she's doing is depriving him of the critical opportunity for self-management. And as an adolescent psychologist, if I have to pick one skill that I want to send my children and your children away to school with, it's self-control. Because most adolescent deaths are failures in self-management. That's the kid who drinks and drives. That's the kid who overdoses at the fraternity party. So self-control is critical. And every time we step in and take over a function that our kids are actually capable of handling, first of all, we rob them of being able to manage a job. We rob them of the self-control it takes when you say, "I'm sorry, honey, sit down, you're going to have to do that again." And, you know, this kind of over-involvement in development, while I think it's incredibly well-intended, and I think it's because we're unbearably anxious, and I'll get to that in a minute, works against everything we know about child development. Okay, so kids, the kind of pressure that's put on kids needs to be tempered by understanding what the developmental tasks of childhood and adolescence are. So, for example, if we're really interested in learning, we reward, if we're going to reward anything, we reward the D that went to a C on a kid who stayed up and really put effort and improvement into it. Learning is not performance. Learning is effort and improvement. And if we keep rewarding only those A's, we're going to end up with great performers and lousy learners. And I have an ongoing beef, and I'm going to win this one because they want to write a grant for me in Marin County. And I said, only if you give me this, because I put three kids through the same high school. And at the end of the year, at the back of the BARC, which is Redwood High School's newspaper, they list where every child is going to school and the school they're going to. So you've got UCLA, UC San Diego, Harvard, Princeton, I don't have a clue, Sonoma State, College of Marin. Yeah. And again, in terms of our values speaking for us, first of all, I know where my kid's going to college. That's not public information. Tell me something about my kid that I don't already know. Tell me something good he did in the school. Tell me something other than, after 4 years of knowing my child, the only thing you have to tell me is something I already know about him, where he's going to college. And for, of course, the argument is it's good for our property values. At some point, we have to take stands ourselves, because we want our children to learn how to take stands, and say it may be good for our property values, it is teaching lousy personal values, and you really, for the kid who's going to Harvard, all it does is make him feel, you know, either superior or more often, frankly, guilty. And for the kid who's going to what's considered, you know, a third-tier school, it makes him feel lousy. It does nothing for anybody except for a small group of people who feel that it raises property values and who, you know, are still sort of living through their kids and want to see the school, you know. I have my kids' schools on my car. So, I think that's actually a complicated issue. I think we are so desperate for a sense of community that we'll take it wherever we can get it. So on the one hand, it is sort of annoying to see the Hummer with the big Harvard sticker on the back of it. On the other hand, there is something about identifying with our kids' schools that I think has to do with our sense of disconnection on all levels. I went to the University of Buffalo. We had a bookstore. I am certain we didn't have any clothing in the bookstore. It was a bookstore, not a clothing store. You walk into the bookstore now, and, you know, like a section of it is books, but the real action's in the clothing. And, you know, it's like, it goes from the, you know, for those who like to be sort of low-key, so there's these incredibly low-key little UCLA, my oldest kid went, to, you know, girls wearing UCLA in huge letters right across their butt. And it interests me. The phenomena interests me. And like most of the things I talk about, it's not as simple as it seems. And it's why, you know, you thanked me for coming here, Tom, but really, it's an honor and a pleasure for me to be able to talk about these issues with the complexity that they really have, as opposed to having to respond to the media, which says, you know, you got 30 seconds, what's the problem? Because it isn't that simple. And so we can laugh, and I laugh, and I've got the sweatshirts, and as a matter of fact, when I wrote my book, it's sort of totally, without thinking about it, my middle son graduated film and theater from USC, and I wrote that. I was telling some story about him, and my editor came back and said, "What are you doing? You just finished saying like you're not supposed to do that." So some of it is just incredibly reflexive. I wrote the book about not being over involved with kids, and my youngest kid and I take sign language together. He takes it for credit, I don't. You know, I take it to do something with him that's interesting to the two of us. And we just went and had to re-sign up for the spring semester. And so we went to the College of Marin together, and without giving it, I'm there. I'm filling out the paperwork. And the woman behind the counter, the secretary, looked at me and she said, "Are you taking the course or is he?" And, you know, moments like that are really critical because they tell us how absolutely reflexively we've become accustomed to taking over for our children. My oldest son called me the first week he was at UCLA and said to me, I tend to tell stories about myself, not because I'm a masochist, but because I'm going to ask you to inventory yourselves as well. And I feel like I can't do that unless I'm willing to do it about myself. So that's why you'll hear some stories of sort of mistakes or gaffes that I've made. So my son calls me first week from school, and I think I've sent off an independent kid. You know, I've read the books. I know what I'm doing. I treat adolescents. And he's there maybe 4 days, and he calls me up, and he says, "Mom, You know that number you always use when I need somebody else's phone number? What is it? 411, Lauren. So, and then I got really worried. I called him back and I said, "Do you know about 911?" So a lot of this is really reflexive. We need to really pay attention to the ways in which we over-involve ourselves. We need to pay attention to the kind of pressure.
This is KZYX and Z, Philo, and you're listening to Madeline Levine on The Price of Privilege.
When we find ourselves pushing too hard, we need to step back and take a look at it. And that, I think, is the hardest thing to do, is to figure out, because I actually really believe that as parents, we know when we're pushing too hard. You know, when I started talking about, you know, B's being F's and stuff like that, and being average, kids have to be allowed to be who they are. And everybody, I mean, I'm working as a psychologist for 25 years, everybody has sort of a fantasy child. You know, when we first have our children, we have an idea of what we're wishing for. It's sort of like same thing with spouses. What we're wishing for. I'm trying to figure out which one comes closer to reality. Probably neither of them. But we all do have this fantasy child, you know, and it's kind of like my kid's going to be great at this, or you know, our whole family plays football. I was just supposedly doing a piece on 2020, which didn't happen. That's a whole other story. But I was on with Christopher Kennedy Lawford, and he was talking about how the assumption was that he would love football and sailing, and he became an addict, and it's a long story. He didn't become an addict because he was supposed to love sailing, but it's part of what we all assume about the particular kind of child we're going to have. And as somebody who just loves children, I love children, and I particularly love teenagers, and there's nothing better to me than an angry teenager, you know? And the reason is because angry teenagers actually have energy left in them. So from a psychologist's point of view, I'd rather see an angry teenager than probably anything else, because usually I can sort of get that anger and, you know, harness it. It means they've got energy. So anyway, okay, I lost my train of thought. What was the point of that, about Lawford and fantasy child? Thank you. Fantasy child. So we all have fantasy kids. We have to do ourselves and our kids an enormous favor, and that is to see the child in front of us, the child we've actually been given. And that, as easy as it sounds and as sentimental as it sounds and as self-evident as it sounds, I think is incredibly, incredibly difficult, because we all bring our histories into the present, and we all have desires and we all have disappointments in life, and there's no easier place to put those desires and disappointments than onto our children. And so if you find yourself pushing your kid, you know, I'm always asked questions like, my kid's crying every time she has to go to soccer. Do you think I should take her off the team? It's sort of like, I want to tell you one of the lesser-known secrets about being a psychologist. You get paid for answering the most astoundingly self-evident questions. And it's really amazing to me. I mean, I often get a call. This is no exaggeration. I'll get a call. I was just in my daughter's room. I know the daughter. She's 13 years old. And I found marijuana. Should I do anything? I was just in my 15-year-old's room, and I found cocaine. But I was going through her drawers, and I know that the most important thing between a child and a parent is trust. Do you think I ought to do anything? I just found condoms in my 14-year-old daughter's room. do you think I ought to? I mean, so, you know, this notion of coming to learn about parenting that you mentioned earlier, I think it's actually coming to remember what you already know about parenting. I think what stuns me about the success of this book, frankly, is I write well, I am not terribly creative, and I think that this issue simply needed a voice, and that the reason that I'm flying around the country and the reason I'm in good hotels and in a ninth printing is not because there are some books that are really brilliant, and we all know the couple of books we've read that are really brilliant. That's not this book. This book has given voice to a problem that every upper middle class community is having in probably an accessible way. But the kinds of issues I'm talking about, how to discipline your kid, how to be connected to your kid, how to form a community for yourself and your children, and these are not rocket science kinds of issues. I think they're issues that, because we are so incredibly anxious, we've forgotten how to navigate. So let me talk about the anxiety for a minute. Well, I had polio when I was a child. I can remember, I got it in August. They came out with the salt vaccine in September. It was like miserable timing for me. But I can remember the level of anxiety of my mother and all the moms on the blocks and my whole community about being in the public swimming pools and drinking from the water fountains. It was an astounding level of anxiety. It had nothing on the level of anxiety that I see today among parents who are worried about whether or not their kid's getting into the right preschool, whether or not their kid has gotten into the right high school or the right college. That kind of anxiety that was once reserved for life and death matters of childhood is now finding its way into whether or not your child is going to get an athletic scholarship. The answer is no. 2-3% of kids play college ball at any level. So that includes, I'm not even talking D1, and I'm not even talking about going pro. It's just at any level. So, I mean, if I'm telling you that something's 2%, there's a 2% chance, there's a heck of a lot larger chance that your kid's going to have to learn how to talk to people and make eye contact and stuff like that. But you don't take them to coaches, right, for eye contact, and you don't take them for coaches to learn the kind of skills you have, Tom. You take them to coaches to make sure that they get on the varsity team because maybe they're going to get an athletic scholarship. And the two kids that I know, and this is anecdotal, the two kids that I know on athletic scholarship, one dropped out, one went to rehab, because the pressures on them were simply unbearable. They were kids who wanted to go to school. And in fact, you know, playing D1 sports is a job, and it's very hard to get an education at the same time. So there's all this tremendous, tremendous push for kids to do well. I'll get back to the anxiety. I didn't forget about it. All this push for kids to do well, and at the end of the day, I mean, obviously, you know, I say 30-40% of kids are in trouble. That means that 60-70% of kids are not. And you know, you got to remember that. Anytime you hear somebody talking about problems with kids, there's two things you need to remember. Whatever scary numbers they come up with, they're still the minority of children. Even if it's as frightening a number as 30-40%, it still means most kids are doing well. And the other thing you have to remember is that we have no idea what percentage of that is parenting. So the assumption is, you know, people come up to me before and after and say, I'm really afraid to hear you talk, Dr. Levine. I probably screwed everything up. And we don't know. What we do know is that probably 50% of who your child is genetics, hardwired, and that leaves the other 50%, and the other 50% is not just parenting. The other 50% is parenting, and it's the culture that we live in, and it's the town you happen to live in, and it's whether or not they happen to be sitting next to a great kid or the local drug dealer in their math class. It's luck. It's a million other things. So, perspective. You know, we need to keep perspective, and we need to remember that parenting is the only thing we have control over. So, would I like to see my Super Sweet 16 off the air, or at least changed as a cultural message? Absolutely. But I know my kid can walk out of the house and see it next door. So, we're probably not going to change the media. We can't change genetics. Luck, you know, it's life. I mean, but we can change how we parent, and that's why I think it's important to listen to messages about parenting. Okay, anxiety. Why are we so anxious? Why are we so worried? And I do this everywhere I speak, and it's a really tough moment for me. So here's my worst parenting moment ever story. So I have three sons. My oldest just graduated law school. He's really, really verbal. And my middle kid's an actor, and he's really, really verbal. And obviously, so am I, with varying degrees of success. And my husband teaches and is a surgeon. He's verbal. But my youngest kid has a little bit of a language learning difference. You know, it depends. And he's not verbal at all. He's all about visual, spatial, math, that kind of thing. And I think I'm totally cool with it, right? I'm in the middle of writing this book, and he finally gets an A-. He comes home, you get the progress report right before the last report card. And he comes home with an A-, and I'm like, oh man, Jeremy, that's so cool, that's terrific, you know, you really did it this semester. And the next day he takes his final, and he comes back with a B+, which means he's going to get a B+ in the class. With everything that I know, I hate this. I really laced into that kid something awful. And he's sitting on the bed with the covers over his head and the tears coming down, and I knew it. You couldn't do it. You couldn't keep it up. And I know, just like we all know, that I'm on the wrong track, that I am really screwing it up, that I have no clue what I'm doing except it's really bad. And I know enough to get out of the room as quickly as I can. And that was the end. He goes to bed. He's beside himself. I'm beside myself. I really, you know, it's like, what got into you? And he comes home from school the next day, and like, just to make it even more humiliating, his teacher in pencil writes next to his B+, kind and considerate, hard worker, one of the nicest children I've ever taught. And I'm like, I can't believe what a jerk I am. And the point, I mean, it's not to humiliate myself in front of an audience. The point is, when I had to go back and think about, why did I do that? My youngest son is as sweet as they come. What was I doing? And I had to really go back and think about my own history. And I realized that I did that to him. My dad died when he was 47 years old. My mom and I and my brother were on public assistance. We had no money. I was just about Jeremy's age. And how did I get to college? I got to college on verbal skills. And how did I get scholarships so that I could get to college? I got it on my verbal skills. I had great verbal SATs. And I wasn't angry at him. That was my history coming into the room. That was my fear that without verbal skills, he was not going to be able to manage in the world. And that wasn't his feeling. That was my feeling from 40 years ago when I wasn't sure that I could manage without verbal skills. And I think every time, and I mean, that was a real, you know, aha moment for me in terms of sometimes parents come in with stories and they're just, you know, they sound awful, and you go like, "How could you do that to your kid?" And it was just an enlightening moment that we all make mistakes, and when we make mistakes, it is our responsibility to go back, figure out why we've made those mistakes. What, you know, Selma Freiberg has that phrase, "Ghosts in the nursery." What in our background is coming into the foreground, and to apologize to our kids. And so that's my thing about inventorying ourselves, because I think most of us know when we're on the wrong track. Most of us know when we're pushing our kids too hard. As soon as your kid has any kind of psychosomatic symptoms, headaches, stomach aches, they're sitting in bed crying like, you push too hard, back off, and figure out why you're pushing as hard as you are. And again, you know, that has to do with seeing the child in front of you. It has to do with my really fully being able to appreciate that my youngest son's skills are in an area that I know nothing about. And if we're lucky, we can, you know, even from a miserable experience like that, we take away something good, which was my understanding of what happened and thinking about, you know, I don't share I don't share much with him. What's it like to be in his skin? He's in with all these like yakety yak people all the time, and he doesn't talk. So we took, it's true. So I asked him about it. I said, is there anything you'd like us to do together? And he said, I'm interested in learning sign language. And I said, well, that sounds really cool. And I had an experience of what it was like to be in his skin, because I couldn't tell you what direction I was facing right now if my life depended on it. And so visual spatial stuff was incredibly difficult for me. He, you know, he buzzed through that course with an A, and if I had gotten graded, I probably would have gotten a D. And my accomplishment was greater, because I tried and I improved, and it was hard, and it was a great lesson for him to see that there were whole arenas that he was outstanding in, and I wasn't even average. I was really, as he would say, sucky at it. So, you know, we can use those kinds of experiences if we can see our kids clearly. I have a story in the book about my middle son, the creative child, waking me up in the morning after morning, and because I write, I go to sleep really late, and because he wanted me to see the sunrise, and I wouldn't do it, and finally I get out of bed, and it was a magnificent thing to see. And sometimes we have to let our children lead us. We are so incredibly busy leading our children, leading them into high achievement, leading them into high performance, and forgetting how and I sort of lose my verbal skills at this point because I don't have good words for it, but how incredibly dear and unique each and every child is. I feel that. I just feel that incredibly strongly.
Well, that was Madeline Levine in St. Helena. And I'm sorry that I couldn't bring the whole thing to you this evening, but we just don't have time. But the 70 minutes that I got will be up on my website, Pacific Sites, PacificSites.com /Tilda Hermes, H-E-R-M-E-S, within the next week. And I hope you enjoyed Dr. Madeline Levine as much as I did. I loved the contact, and she loved the contact very much. And she asked me what we put in our water up here, because people were so warm. But she really is the spark. And as I told you, the show will be posted on my website. And I did have a couple of calls while the show was going on, and one person was saying, "I have to have this. I have to have this. How can I get it?" And another person was saying, "I just don't really think this person is talking about kids in our area." And it was good to hear from both people, and I hope you will continue to connect with me. Thank you to Mary Eigner for helping with the editing. The two main areas that Dr. Levine focuses on are character and connection. Testing and labeling do not support building the character of the child and does not encourage them to follow their own drummer. Her work really supports the Alliance for Childhood. We've talked about the Alliance for Childhood. You can find that on the web at allianceforchildhood.org. Bonding to mother and parents and family is crucial to the emotional development of the child. Caregivers who themselves are suffering from a failure to connect can gain skills and experience in making connections by loving themselves first and then sharing with children and community so that the beat goes on. In future shows, we'll focus on violence and the arts and how there's a good play there. And I will bring you the voices of teachers in our area, many of whom I have worked with, and others who I have not worked with. Last month, we did a show on CalLEAP and fundraising through property transactions for schools. And Jason Rogers from CalLEAP let us know that for any property transactions where mentioning that you heard CalLEAP on KZYX and Z, if you mention that, CalLEAP will make a donation to the station. CalLEAP works a lot like eScript, which I assume many of you are familiar with. So if you are looking at a property transaction, please think of us. I don't know if there are any more raffle tickets left on the hybrid Honda Civic, but you can go to the website if you want to, or call during the working hours, 9 to 5, at 707-895-2324 to get a raffle ticket. Tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock is the Access Show. This week on the Access program with Norman Duvall, guests will be Marsha Wharf, County Clerk Recorder, and Supervisor David Colfax, Chairman of the Board. So you'll want to hear that if you can. And then at 1 o'clock tomorrow, Friday afternoon, Corporations in Democracy, join Molly Morgan with her guest Percy Schmeiser, the Canadian canola farmer who was sued by Monsanto for growing genetically modified crops that he never planted. Percy took his case all the way to the Canadian Supreme Court and became an outspoken opponent of the dangers of GMOs. In 2004, his story inspired many voters who made Mendocino County the first in the country to ban the growing of GMOs. So tune in to find out what happened to Percy and the GMO debate in the last 2.5 years. Yes, some promotions here. The Anderson Valley Land Trust is featuring a Filgren Farm Creek Restoration Tour on Saturday, November 18th at 11 a.m. at 11600 Anderson Valley Way in Boonville. Chris Tubit will lead a tour of his successful stream restoration methods on Anderson Creek and demonstrate the methods he developed. Drive to the front of the barn to join the tour. And Tree of Life Charter School Secondary Classroom is having a romantic Mediterranean dinner and live entertainment tomorrow evening, Friday, November 17th. There will be two seatings, one at 6 p.m. and one again at 7:15. At Tree of Life Charter School is at 241 Ford Road in Ukiah, and you can call and get tickets from by calling 462-0913. The Cool Cats are offering this romantic dinner with live entertainment, and child care and a children's menu will be available. Well, coming up, we're going to have Earth and Sky, and then W. Dan and the Treehouse with some good laughs. And I want to thank you all for listening. And you can always contact me at hermes@pacific.net. That's hermes@pacific.net. Or Athena at KZYX, P.O. Box 1, Philo, California, 95466. Peace and goodwill to all of you. Have a wonderful Thanks of Giving. And now up is coming Earth and Sky. Good night, everyone. And thank you for listening to Education Now. Here we go. Earth.